This week on Unforgotten.
Since we aren't actually investigators and we just play them on the podcast, we asked Captain Scott Bonner to join us this week to give us his perspective on Mont's case. Mont spent Thanksgiving Day with his family at his sister Leanne's house. Gil remembers Mont standing in the kitchen talking to somebody on the phone. She doesn't know who it was.
It seemed a very casual conversation.
And he said, "Tell Dad I'll meet him Saturday morning."
The plan had been he and Dr. Holly were going on Saturday, and now he's changed his mind. Mont stopped by Sinclair. He stops at the Chevron gas station, makes a couple of calls, and then after 9:35, that's it. Mont's Tahoe was actually seen later that night pulling into the Seagrass camp. Around 4 to 5 a.m., a couple of people see a dark-colored four-door pickup leaving the Holly camp.
And they can't find anybody that'll talk to them that was there at the camp. That's disturbing itself.
Hey, everyone. This is Sellers.
And this is Stormy.
And this is Unforgotten.
Where each episode will highlight unsolved missing, murdered, and suspicious death cases in Alabama in order to raise awareness and hopefully obtain some answers for victims and their families.
Please remember that any individual referenced in the podcast should be considered innocent until found guilty in a court of law, and any opinions or views expressed in the podcast are solely those of participants. Listener discretion is advised, as some of the content discussed in the podcast may contain violence or graphic descriptions and may not be suitable for all audiences.
Be sure to join our Unforgotten Patreon channel today to gain exclusive benefits, including early access to ad-free episodes and bonus content. By subscribing, you'll also be supporting the efforts of ACCA in assisting families and raising awareness for Alabama cold cases.
And now for part two of episode 26, Mont Holly.
Hey guys, and welcome back. This week we're continuing our discussion of Mont Holly's case. Last week we kind of talked about who Mont was when he was younger, growing up, and the person that he was to his family as a son and a brother and an uncle.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was really interesting. Funny. I liked some of those stories.
I know. Yeah.
We got a couple of text messages from friends of Mont's about they really liked the football highlights.
That's awesome.
When the news of Mont's disappearance initially broke, there was a good bit of press coverage covering the search for Mont. And then subsequently when he was found, and there was some follow-up on that, kind of looking for progress updates. And then it just kind of dropped off.
Yeah.
It's disappointing, and it's disappointing that none of that press coverage discussed anything personal about him, his life, who he was, and that nobody really kind of stuck with maintaining that. And that happens in a lot of cases.
It does,
but there were other things that were going on at that time.
Well, there were. There were several major events during that time frame. Saddam Hussein was captured in December of 2003, so that was
like major news coverage.
Yeah. Really big, yeah.
Like dominated the news.
And just a couple of years later, in 2005, Natalie Holloway disappeared in Aruba, which we know was a big highlight again this year. So,
yep.
So yeah, talk about the difference in coverage for women versus men, though.
Because that Natalie's disappearance, and it doesn't diminish the importance of her disappearance over anybody else's.
No.
But that's a case that everybody knows.
Right.
It's been covered in documentaries. It's been covered in docuseries and evening news broadcasts. And obviously, it's more recent now because Vandersloot's been arrested and extradited back to Alabama on those charges, extortion charges.
Right. And I see his name come up in like Google alerts all the time.
Yeah.
So.
But it's something that stayed in the news, obviously, for a really long time. And there's so many of these cases, especially when you look at men that are in very similar situations, they don't get that type of coverage.
Uh-uh. No.
And this isn't, it's something that was highlighted, I think, a lot whenever Gabby Petito was missing.
Yeah.
And people started talking about the differences in the coverage for white women versus black women. And it's, there is a difference in the coverage that's received.
There's a huge difference. Yeah.
But there is a huge difference when you look at men.
Yeah. I mean, it has to be something pretty extraordinary. I think it's almost because you see the coverage more on the perpetrators that are men and the victims that are women.
And I think that just goes to show that
stereotypical. But.
Exactly. That's what I was fixing to say, that there, it still just goes to show this kind of maybe implicit bias here, you know, or this stereotype that men just, they're either responsible for it or they can take care of themselves and really there's no need to talk about it.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I think there's been big steps in that, but it's still, I mean, from as recently as the early 2000s, as we're talking about, but there's a long way to go. Long, long way to go for not just men, but everybody.
Exactly. Hopefully we'll see that start to balance out, especially now that it seems like more attention's being brought to that imbalance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I would like to see it even out a little better.
Oh, yeah. We've seen so many. I mean, we have a couple of cases that you would have thought would have had huge attention on them that have not.
That have not. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, it would be great, like you said, to see that balance out and some of these cases get a little more attention.
I think probably the one that, like, comes to mind first, and it's not even an Alabama case, but it's Daniel Robinson.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who disappeared, you know, around the same time that Gabby Petito did.
Yeah.
But his dad's still struggling.
He's really kind of forced that into the headlines as best he can. His dad did.
Yeah. He tries.
Still, I mean, it's been on a couple of news things now, but for the most part, it's still, you know, if he's not pushing it, it's not really out there.
And he's had to do a lot of the investigation part on his own.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, he moved to take care of this, you know, to fight for his son. And
hopefully we see a change.
Agreed.
It's getting there. It's just slow. Slow moving. Change is slow.
Change is definitely slow.
It is slow.
On a lot of fronts.
Yes. Even in justice, you know.
Yeah.
Here in the court system, we have fast track cases and then not fast track cases, basically.
Oh, yeah.
But even the fast track cases aren't what you would consider fast track. I mean, they're supposed to be. But you see them and you look at the summary and it's like fast track at the top. But then it's been going on for years. And you're like, that doesn't seem very fast. It's just, that's how things go.
Well,
continuances on continuances on continuances.
Yeah. I mean, you see all over the place, you know, any kind of like appeals, they pretty much, you know, once a person is convicted, and this is like totally off topic, well, sort of off topic, but anytime somebody has an appeal, they can, if they're already in prison, you can pretty much expect it's going to be years before they get an outcome. Not months, not even a year, usually. I mean, depends on where they are in the process, but generally speaking, you know, it could take 5-10 years before they even see a courtroom.
Yep. Yep.
So it's all the system needs revamping, unfortunately. And I know people start working on it, but
you just have to get everybody on board. And I just don't know.
I don't know how you can.
There's too many people that aren't really willing to get on board with that. There's other distractions, I think.
Well, there is. And I'm sure there's ulterior motives to keeping things the way it is.
Yeah.
But.
So we ended part one of Mont's episode with a discussion about the Segrist family and their history and Mont's connection to the Segrist. For those who aren't familiar with Mont's case, you may be wondering why that was even really all that important. But as we talked about briefly, and we'll get more into today, their property was where Mont's Tahoe was found.
Right. And just a note, we posted a couple of maps over in the Unforgotten Patreon channel for the TAKE members. And if you want to go check that out, you could subscribe and follow along with that. There's also a detailed timeline on Uncovered, which will help you follow along as well. And we'll link the Patreon and Mont's ACCA page and the Uncovered page all in our episode details.
Since we aren't actually investigators and we just play them on the podcast, we asked a real investigator, Captain Scott Bonner, a retired police captain and cold case investigator who currently works as a law enforcement specialist with Voyager Labs, specializing in artificial intelligence investigations, who also happens to be one of our favorites, to join us this week to give us his perspective on Mont's case. Do we call you Captain now that you're retired?
Yeah, that's what I was going
to
ask.
We're supposed to keep the title, you know, once we're retired, but, you know, it doesn't matter. I've been called a lot worse in my career, so whatever y'all choose to call me, I'm good with it either.
So tell us a little bit about what Voyager's doing, or what you're doing now.
What Voyager is it's an artificial intelligence investigation labs. We go, well, myself, we have several different divisions in Voyager, but I go around to other agencies and somewhat familiarize them with our product. And what it does is it is a real deep dive into people's social media. It can do topology connections where it can connect, you know, this individual with this individual. Sometimes that may mean human trafficking or drug trafficking or homicides, gang related, anything to where you'd need to find a nexus between two people. Our system's great at, and it's also great at monitoring, you know, special events, races, football games, you know, anything like that where there may be some issues that might come up. We have a monitoring system where we could set up different keywords and stuff to alert the agencies of something that might happen.
That's pretty awesome, because that's not at all what I had in my mind. Like, I think, I don't know what I thought it was.
Well, you know, it's a lot of people are like that, and myself included. You know, I think we've talked before. I started in 1997, and in early 2000s, when we were swapping over to computers, you know, I fought it because, you know, I was under assumption that I could handwrite a report a lot quicker than I could type one. And, you know, and that mindset, unfortunately, we still have some guys that mindset today. But AI is the new investigations. I mean, it's y'all know what AI can do, you know, and as long as it's used properly,
yeah,
it's good. Now, what our company does, we don't do anything past the password. All of our stuff is open source or inferred. So, you know, it allows us to sanitize stuff for court purposes, too, with these cases.
Oh, wow. That is pretty awesome. Like, I feel like, can we use this stuff? Because that would make researching so much easier.
Oh, it is. It, you know, and it reduces agencies' their time that these case agents spend, you know, hundreds of hours on these cases. And this product allows them to, you know, to get it done faster so they can move on to something else. So it's a huge, huge time saver. And, you know, I wish I would have had it, especially back in, you know, in my investigations days at Talladega County, where, you know, we had a lot of crime and a lot of investigations. It is great. It is really great.
Yeah. So I have a question for you. This is like on a purely, I'm just interested in this whole AI thing because there's so much controversy over AI. So do you ever have like any pushback or any legal like things that you have to be careful of when you're using the system because it's AI?
Yes, ma'am, we do. And of course, Meta and some of the others, you know, have sued any AI investigations company. And it's just, in my opinion, obviously I'm not a lawyer, but it's just a, you know, something to show the people who don't agree with, you know, us getting their information, us as in law enforcement, you know, mm-hmm. it's just something to show them that they're trying to, you know, to make it safer or whatever. But, you know, the way I look at it is with Meta, whoever, if you had to pick a side, or if it were me, I would pick a side just trying to protect our kids and trying mm-hmm. to protect our nation, you know, because what mm-hmm. we do, we're not on there looking, you know, to see what they're doing in their private life or anything. But with ours, that's why we use mostly open source investigations. So mm-hmm. you potentially could get anything that we get, it would just take a long time to do it, you know, via several different search engines and everything. And right. It's just simplified.
Yeah, you know, it's like having thousands of detectives at your fingertips.
Meanwhile, social media is over there tracking all your movements and giving you personalized ads.
Right.
You know.
But that's okay to, you know, to Meta and some of the other ones. And, you know, and like I said, any tool that you get, I don't care if it's from a screwdriver to a hammer to a gun or anything else, any tool you can get your hands on, as long as it's used in the right way, will help you. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the other side of that coin is people use it for the wrong purposes. But that's something that I don't think we'll ever be able to stop.
Yep. Yeah. It's all about responsible use, you know, and being exactly. accountable. Yep.
I would, I'm under the way I think about this is anything that can help save children, save innocent people, anything that can, you know, like with these keyword searches and monitoring programs. I mean, this kind of stuff's huge because if it insults somebody or makes somebody mad, well, you know, they need to question why they're mad about it, you know, why they are insulted about it. Mm-hmm. Because if it protects my kids and your families, my families, hey, I'm for it. Let's do it, you know.
Yeah, because the flip side of that is if it wasn't out there and there was this ability to kind of foresee some tragic event happening and it wasn't being utilized, then there'd be all of this uproar about, well, we had the ability to stop this and we didn't.
Absolutely. It's just like, you know, to go back to 9/11, you know, we'll never know, I don't think, as a country. But it's like, you know, so many people say, well, they knew this was coming. They didn't do anything about it, you know, yada, yada. And I don't know if it was true or not, but I do know that if I can get something to, you know, nothing's going to tell the future, but if I can get something to help with that, please, you know, give it to me and my agency because, you know, it's, what's that saying? Don't buy the insurance once your, you know, house is burnt down or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah. You know, you can't go back and put lives back in order once when a tragedy happens. But if mm-hmm. you can do anything to prevent it, you know, why not?
Absolutely. There's not a crystal ball out there to know with 100% certainty, but you can, you know, put some kind of security blanket there.
Absolutely. And the thing with AI is it's a force multiplier. You know, as a former administrator, I know how hard it is to get, you know, everybody to come to work. You know, you get those sick days, you get flu season, you know, you get allergy season. People's got kids. I mean, it's life. Trust me, you know, I've been there and still there, you know. But this, you know, our system, it don't take a sick day. It don't, you know, take a vacation day. It's there 24/7. And it's never going to take place of a police officer, an investigator, or an analyst ever. But it just helps them do their job quicker. It's just like going from a paintbrush to a paint roller, you know.
Right. You could cover a bigger area in a shorter amount of time.
Yes, ma'am.
Yep. That sounds like a good tool. And probably yeah, well, it needs to be that. A little more utilized than probably what it is. So pretty impressive.
It is very impressive.
I appreciate that.
Well, let's jump into what we're talking about today. We're going to use Mont's Uncovered Timeline as a reference because it's awesome and not because we put it together. So don't hesitate to interrupt us. I tend to get on soapboxes sometimes and I have to like stop myself. So just interrupt us if you're like, hey, I got something to say. Yeah. shut your mouth for a minute. I got an opinion. I got something to say. So just as a couple of background details, though, in 2003, we talked about last week that Mont was kind of between jobs. According to the Hollies, Mont had been working for EMJ Construction, building Lowe's buildings kind of across the U.S. And just before his disappearance, he had had an interview with a construction company in North Carolina. And I believe it was Hill Construction, but I'm not 100% certain. And he was waiting to hear back on whether they were going to offer him the job. So during that November time period, Mont was staying with the Hollies at their house in Montgomery. And he was going back and forth between their hunting camp, which they called the farm, which and it was located in Shorter, and then their lake house at Lake Martin.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
About a week or so prior to his disappearance, Dr. Holly had given Mont $300 in cash because he said Mont was kind of running low on funds, waiting, kind of being in between the jobs. We do have Mont's cell phone bill detail, but it doesn't have the location data. We don't have that information. And in 2003, that information wasn't as detailed anyway as what it is now. And I don't think it was also, I don't think it was something, and maybe it was a little bit, but cell phones weren't as, they weren't as important to everyday use as they are now. People didn't keep them on them like they do now. And absolutely, they weren't, most people don't have landlines now.
Yeah.
So
it was only a couple of years before that, though, where that people started picking up that you could actually do any analytics for investigations. I think like a perfect example is Adnan Syed. They have all the controversy pings over the cell phone pings. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, but that was pretty new, I think, at that time. And that was only a couple of years, a few years before this. So
the one thing from his cell phone bill, though, is that it'll say where the call is coming to and from as far as like the state. So it doesn't look really like Mont traveled very much outside of Alabama in that November timeframe, like here and there, but not a whole lot. Mm-hmm. So it did kind of at least give a reference, you know, for his physical location during that frame. So it's not like he was all over the country like he had been.
Right.
And all of that, I guess, kind of comes into play because the money is something that gets brought up later. So on November 27th, 2003, Thanksgiving Day with his family at his sister Leanne's house. His mom said that he watched football with his grandfather and they all had dinner.
And we had Thanksgiving and then he came home and he and my daddy watched all the football games.
And in our early conversations with the Hollies, Mont's mother Gail told us that she recalled him being a little bit quieter than he normally was, but it wasn't anything unusual and it didn't stand out in a way that made them concerned about anything. And the following day, which is November 28th, 2003, the Friday after Thanksgiving, Mont spent the day with his parents at their home. Gail said that he basically just napped and watched TV all day,
right,
which is kind of my ideal day after Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
And that was pretty much the extent of his activity of that day, you know.
Day after Thanksgiving, he said, I'm really tired. And I said, how can you be tired? You slept most of the afternoon. Stop watching TV. And he said, well, Dad,
pretty mundane.
Lazy, relaxed day.
Mm-hmm. Just thinking, you know, after a big, long day of cooking, that sounds awesome.
Yeah.
I know he didn't, but that would be more like yeah, what we would have.
Yep. We looked at his cell phone records, and I don't think he was very active on the phone that day. So obviously that kind of coincides with they were doing family stuff.
Right. Yeah. And I think Leanne, or no, it was Lisa, I think even commented that he was a little quieter than normal, but again, didn't think too much of it.
From his cell phone records, he really didn't make a whole lot of phone calls on the 27th or the 28th, with one minor caveat that Hollies did have landlines, and they told us that Mont was more of, they actually called it a creature of convenience, and mm-hmm, that if the landline phone was closer than a cell phone, like he probably would have picked up the landline phone. So it's possible that he could have used one of the landlines, and we think that they probably had them at their house in Montgomery, the farm, and the lake house. But since he does have activity on his cell phone, we're assuming that he really probably used that as his main method of communication.
Right. Yeah.
Can't confirm that, but that's what it appears to be. And we don't have any records from the landline to say any different.
That's what I was wondering about, the landline records, you know, which I know they're not as in-depth, but, you know, sometimes they can help.
Yeah, and I don't know. I did ask them if they had copies of those by chance, and they didn't have those. You know, it's 20 years now, and they had some documents, but that wasn't one of the records that they had. So we don't have those. I wish we did, because I'd like to be able to cross-reference those and see if any of these same numbers popped up.
Sure. You know, that's a good thing, I guess, for today, you know, versus the cold cases is today, you know, we have video surveillance, we have cell phone records, we have pings, we have social media, you know, we got all that stuff to look at and analyze, and it makes it so much easier. But with these cold cases, normally you don't have any of that. And right. That's a huge challenge.
And trying to go back, you can't go back and get a lot of that stuff. Now you have the cloud, where a lot of stuff gets uploaded to the cloud. Like, even surveillance videos sometimes get uploaded to the cloud. Mm-hmm. But you can't necessarily go back and get that. And traffic cameras are crazy now. You have them just everywhere, but not really back then.
Right.
So looking at his cell phone records, it looks like the first indication we have that he made a call was he around 12:41, so a little bit after lunch, he makes a phone call from his cell phone. So he was making calls back and forth a little after lunch. And we're assuming all of that happened from his parents' house in Montgomery, because they said he was there all day. Then around 6, Mont calls one of his close friends and invites him to go to the camp that weekend, to the farm, to go hunting. But that friend had a prior engagement and was going to be out of town, so he wasn't going to be able to go. At some point after that, Gail remembers Mont standing in the kitchen talking to somebody on the phone. She doesn't know who it was. She said their house is kind of an open layout. She was standing in the kitchen doing something, and Mont was kind of across the room. And she said it was a friendly call. She remembers Mont kind of like laughing. It wasn't anything. He wasn't mad. It wasn't a heated conversation. It wasn't like it was obviously somebody that he knew. And he made a comment to them, something about, "You're just now eating Thanksgiving dinner." And it's not a very long phone call. And then after he gets off the phone, he tells her, "I think I'm going to go ahead and go out to the farm. You know, Dad and I are supposed to be going tomorrow anyway. Just tell Dad I'll meet him there." And nobody really knows what changed his mind about going with his dad on Saturday to, "I'm just going to go ahead and go on Friday," other than maybe he was just bored and looking for something to do.
Yeah. And we kind of get that from his activity, maybe, but, you know, what little we know. But yeah, it seemed a very casual conversation from what she said. So it wasn't like he was even whispering, you know, like he was making plans that he didn't want anybody to hear even. It was just a normal conversation.
And we can't pinpoint who it is that he's talking to either. Mm-hmm. There's a couple of calls around this time, so we're not really sure if this would have been a friend that he was talking to, just an acquaintance. We're not sure who this can be attributed to. Not sure if whatever this phone call was about, because she didn't hear the whole conversation, if maybe that's what triggered this change of plans. But the plan had been he and Dr. Holly were going on Saturday, and now he's changed his mind and he's going on Friday.
Well, you're just now eating Thanksgiving dinner then the following day, you know, would indicate maybe that person had been out of town or, you know, traveling or something. And I wish you knew who it was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know,
we do too, because I would like to know if that was a call to somebody about trying to hang out and maybe they couldn't because they already had plans.
Right.
You know,
that's what it sounds like.
And it looks like, just based on his call log, that happened between 5 and 6 o'clock, somewhere around in there. We're estimating about 6:45 to 7, Mont stopped by Sinclair's, a restaurant slash bar in Montgomery. It was about 5 minutes away from the Hiley's house. And assuming that he left, you know, pretty quickly after that phone call, we're saying the last call on his cell phone record was at 6:35. We're giving him that like 10-minute window to like leave.
Right. I mean, you have to park, go, you know, walk in the place, you know, walk out.
Yeah. Because a lot of times when you have other places like the farm or the lake house or whatever, you have things you need at those places already. So you don't really have to pack.
Right. Yeah.
And since he had been kind of back and forth to those places already over the course of the month, I'm assuming he probably didn't pack a bag to go. That
I would probably guess not.
Like when we go to our camp for hunting season, like our stuff, we leave our hunting gear and everything there during hunting mm-hmm. season. So yeah. We don't really take anything with us outside of like regular clothes, because we don't necessarily leave those, but like our camo and things like that, that's already there.
Yeah. But it's kind of the same way, like when people go, you know, camping like in an RV, we have an RV that we keep fully stocked.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we just, you know, pack what things that we want to keep, you know, take from home. But most of the stuff is already there, food and, you know, rain gear and, you know, all of those things.
And I know I always compare what my kids do, but like my son's bag compared to my daughter's bag, way different.
Well,
way different.
That's you know, pretty normal for us girls.
Yeah. So I feel like he probably didn't have a lot to do. Like he probably was just like, all right, see y'all later, and hopped in the truck, you know? So I don't think he probably would have had to pack.
Yeah, I agree.
He makes that stop between 6:30 and 6:40 at Sinclair's. We're not exactly sure how long he's there, but, you know, it's 5 minutes from the Hiley's house. And then we know that between 7 and 7:30, he stops at the Chevron gas station just off County Road 30 in Shorter and purchases beer. I think it was called the Tiger Pride at the time. That's about a 21-minute drive. So he couldn't have been at Sinclair's for very long. 5 minutes up the road, that's 6:45. You got a 20-minute drive out to Shorter. Assuming, just saying he stops at Sinclair's for 10 minutes, then that's going to put him, if you say there's 6:45, puts him at the gas station at 7:05.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
I wonder, it may be irrelevant, but I wonder how much beer he purchased. If they had a receipt or something, because
they know, did have a receipt and they could see it on the surveillance.
Because and he's still alone at this time, right? Nobody's with him.
As far as we know, he's alone in the video.
Because just my thinking, you know, if I'm going to a camp where I know there's going to be a lot of people at, you know, and I'm going to go hang with them, I'm going to get more than a 6-pack or a case. You know, I'll grab a couple mm-hmm. of them. You know, because you don't want to be that guy.
And well, here's the other thing, too, talking about that, actually. How'd he pay for it?
Right.
Yeah.
Maybe he had some money. He just didn't tell his dad, you know, and his dad gave him the $300, you know, and he may have been using his money first, you know, or something
other
like
things.
That.
True.
Yeah.
True. Yeah.
But he must have something, you know, some kind of means.
He's got some money somewhere. Unless they're, the only other thing is that it's not just him.
Yeah.
Right.
So these are just like windows that we're thinking would make sense.
Right.
We could be completely off. But if somebody saw him at Sinclair's at a certain time, you should
that
probably
would be
let
helpful.
Us know.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Or I if mean, you saw him at the gas station.
Right. And based on, you know, what we know, it can only be within a certain window. So.
Right. That's based on the information that we've received, you know. He couldn't have stopped at the gas station later than 7:30, as of what we know right now.
Mm-hmm.
There could be information out there to indicate differently. We would love to know.
Yeah.
Because we've been trying really hard to fill in his movements through the day. So this is kind of where we're at with that. And we would love for anybody that can help fill in these gaps to let us know.
Yep, exactly.
Then a little before 8 p.m., Mont presumably arrives at the camp we're guessing he leaves from that gas station going straight to the camp. I keep calling it the camp because that's what we call it, but they call it the farm.
I keep calling
it the wrong thing, but Mont arrives at the farm a little bit before 8. The farm was roughly 9 miles away from the gas station and a 10-minute drive. This is all based on Google.
Mm-hmm.
So that puts in there 8-ish.
Right.
And at 8:10, he calls the Holly residence, but it doesn't look like that call was answered because it lasted no more than a minute, no longer than 1 minute.
Right.
Well, and like you said, they may not have heard it, you know, especially a landline, you know, back then.
Mm-hmm. Or if they were on the phone, you know, didn't click out. Did he get a busy signal? You know, if there wasn't call waiting, did he get a busy signal?
Right.
Yeah. I wonder if there is a machine or anything like that.
Then between 8:31 and 9:35 p.m., Mont makes a handful of calls over that next hour to friends. None of those calls stand out as unusual. They don't last for any extended period of time. And then the last activity on his phone is an outgoing call at 9:35, which again lasts for no longer than 1 minute and doesn't appear to have been answered.
Yeah, right.
We don't have the location data, so we don't know where he's at. So we're just assuming he's at the camp at this point, at the farm. After 9:35, that's it. There's no more activity on Mont's phone until Sunday when they find the phone. That's where his kind of documentation of his activity just basically stops. Between 11:20 and 11:30 p.m., Mont's Tahoe was seen pulling in to the Seagrass camp, which is called Granny's, followed by another vehicle.
Which is interesting in itself.
It is. According to sources, the Seagrass were hosting a small get-together at their camp that evening.
Right. Yep.
So there were people there. Not sure how many. We don't know exactly who was there other than just that there were people there.
And we don't know that Mont was actually driving the Tahoe. We just know that his vehicle pulled in with another vehicle behind it.
Right. And then we move into November 29th around 5 a.m.
Which this is interesting as well.
It is. Witnesses reported a dark-colored pickup truck leaving the Holly Farm. Since we posted Mont's case card series on the ACCA pages, we've learned that a couple of people have come forward with information to potentially identify the vehicle leaving the Hollies, which is huge.
Right. Yep.
And we appreciate that, and the Hollies really appreciate that. So
more of this, please.
Yes, keep that information coming, because that is the type of stuff that is going to help move this case forward. Around 2:30 on November 29th, Dr. Holly arrives at the farm as planned. When he arrives, he finds that the gate's unlocked, the metal storage building's unlocked and open. The front door to the trailer is open. All the lights are on inside the trailer, and that the TV was also on and so loud that he could hear it from where he was parked outside. But Mont nor his Tahoe were anywhere to be found. And what Dr. Holly told us was he just assumed that Mont got a call from a friend about coming to watch the football game and got distracted and just left everything. Dr. Holly said he went hunting, didn't get anything, and then went home. He kind of locked everything up, headed back to the house. And then the next thing is that they get the call on Sunday from Dale Seagrass saying, hey, Mont's Tahoe is here.
And they can't find anybody that'll talk to them that was there at the camp?
No.
I mean, that's disturbing in itself.
I agree, yeah.
I think so.
Saturday afternoon, we usually went out about 2 or 2:30. We had a mobile home out there. There was a gate and a driveway that was probably 50 yards long, and there was a large metal building where we kept our four-wheelers, and we had a tractor and some other farm stuff in. And when I pulled in, the gate was open, and that was unusual for Mont because he tended to get kind of spooky when he was out there anyway. So he'd lock everything up. He'd lock the gate when he got in, and the gate was open. And I pulled up past the metal building, and the door of the metal building was open. And I pulled up in front of the the trailer and the front door was open and the TV was on, and it was on loud enough that I could hear it out in the front. So I went up there and went in and turned the TV off and looked around, and I mean, he obviously wasn't there. And it happened to be the weekend that Alabama played in Hawaii. And I figured what happened was one of his friends called him and said, "Hey, Mont, come over and we'll watch the game and have a beer or whatever." And I figured he just got distracted and left everything like it was.
Because he knew you were coming out.
Yeah, because he knew I was coming out there, I guess. And so I went ahead and hunted and didn't get anything and locked up and came in and didn't hear from him that night. And the next day, which was Sunday, is when we got a phone call from Dale Seegers saying that his truck was out there behind his mother's house, which was Mike Seegers' grandmother. We went out, and they were out picking pecans up. They had a lot of pecan trees in the front yard, and his wife commented to Gail that they never went out there. And why they went out there that day, I have no idea. She said they were picking up pecans, and of course, his car was in the back. The windows were down. As I recall, the keys were in the ignition, and it started. His briefcase was on the front seat. His billfold, as I recall, was in it, and there was money in the billfold. I had given him like $300 the week before because he was running low on funds. We were able to account for all the money, so, I mean, he wasn't robbed or anything.
But one thing was that when we went to the Seegers' house, Dale looked at us like he didn't know who we were. And he walked around the car and he says, "Ah, Florida tags. I believe he was driving drugs down here."
Not like they're strangers. I mean, they're, you know, joining property, neighbors or whatever, and friends. And did they go to the same school and everything?
Yes.
Yes.
So we were going back and doing our research. And then after talking to the Hollies, the house where Mont's Tahoe was found was actually, they called it Granny's house, but it was Dale and Wade's grandparents' house. And I think Dale actually owned it at the time. Currently, Mike Seegerist owns it, if you look at the property map. But Wade Seegerist, who is Dale's brother, he was the principal at Montgomery Academy. Wade's son, Clinton, and Mike, they were a grade below Mont, but they went to Montgomery Academy. They played on the same sports team as Mont. Mike ended up transferring to Tallahassee in like 1987, I think. But they were in school together. And we've been told that when the Hollies had not owned the farm maybe a year, 2 years at this point, it was kind of a more recent purchase for them. But that basically, once they bought that, Mont had hung out with them on occasions, hung out with Mike and Clinton again, that he would maybe go hunting with them at some point, or, you know, it wouldn't have been uncommon for him to have been over there. Now, that could be hearsay, but there are people that will say that. And the Hollies say, you know, we didn't necessarily socialize with them per se, but we knew all of those people. We've known them since we moved to Montgomery. Dr. Holly said he actually went into, when he first moved to Montgomery and went into practice, he went into practice with one of the Seegerist cousins. So they knew the Hollies.
Hmm. Yeah, that's, you know, I don't understand why. No, because, you know, like I said, I may be imagining something different in my mind, but, you know, I'm having trouble thinking that nobody there would tell the police or whoever, you know, anything, or the family anything. I mean, you know, if there were people there that just seen him come up and that's all that happened, I don't know why they wouldn't say, "Yeah, I seen him there, you know, around so-and-so time, you know, he was drinking or whatever," but didn't think anything about it, you know, something.
Exactly. I can think of all of these reasons to say why his Tahoe would have been found there, but he might not be with it and not have, you know, "Oh, somebody drove him home. Oh, he took off walking. Oh, you know," all of these things. But to say we didn't know it was here, we just found it, we didn't know whose vehicle it was, because Dale calls on Sunday and says, oh, Mont's Tahoe's here. The Hollies go out there. So this is now, it gets there on Friday. It's been there Friday, Saturday, Sunday. When the Hollies get there, there's a lot of people out there. Dale's wife tells Gail, I don't even know why we came out here. We never come out here. He just said he wanted to pick pecans today.
Of all days.
Of all days. It wasn't planned. It wasn't a planned trip out there. It was just spur of the moment. And he says he didn't know whose Tahoe it was until he looked at the ID in the wallet, because Mont's keys were in the ignition. The windows were down. His wallet was in there. His briefcase was in there. His truck cranked right up. It wasn't like it just stopped. So things were in his truck, like he just pulled in, parked, and it was there. And he walks around and looks at the tag, and he's like, oh, Florida plates. It must be a drug deal or something like that. And immediately you think, you didn't know whose vehicle this was.
Right. I mean, their camp is right down the way. They've known each other from school days, you know, not him personally, but, you know, the kids knew each other. You know, that's not, these people aren't unknown to each other.
Yeah, it's approximately 2.5 miles mm-hmm. from the Hollies camp to the Seegers camp.
Well, you know, when his window's being left down in late November in Alabama, if he did it himself, I would think that he didn't intend on being out of the vehicle for just a few minutes. Mm-hmm. That's not something that I think he would roll the windows down and intend on leaving it for a long period of time. Because, right. You know, that time of year, and he's got stuff in there that he cares about. You know, men are usually particular about their trucks and SUVs and stuff. And mm-hmm. I think if he did drive it there, then that's where something happened.
The Seegers were never identified in any of the newspapers. If we hadn't talked to the Hollies, we wouldn't have known exactly where Mont's Tahoe was found. They actually told us that information because they were just called property owners in all of the papers, articles that were published. And it just said property owners say they don't know anything about what happened. So they go out and check on the Tahoe. Then they decide, well, let's go check the lake house and see if he went there. Because, you know, when Dr. Holly got there on Saturday, the gate to the camp was open. All of the lights in the trailer were on. The TV was on. He said the volume was so loud he could hear it outside. They had a big metal, like, barn type area where they kept their equipment. They're like, they call it a golf cart. I'm assuming it wasn't a side-by-side. I guess it was a golf cart. Four-wheelers, tractors, things like that. That was open. All of these things that seem kind of off, but also at the same time, Mont was kind of like fly by the seat of his pants, and he assumed he got distracted and just went to hang out with his buddies and left it open. Well, then they get this call about his truck. They go check the lake house. Mont's not at the lake house. They go back to the camp, and that's when they start noticing, wait, there's more to what's going on here than we initially thought.
Coming up next week on part 3 of the series finale, Mont Hiley.
They get this call about his truck. They go check the lake house. Mont's not at the lake house.
And after returning to the farm, the Hileys notice things that Dr. Hiley hadn't noticed on Saturday. Mont's wet boots beside each other on the front porch.
His pants are in the bedroom. It looks like he's literally just stepped out of them.
And his cell phone, along with $100 cash, was still in the pocket.
He didn't have a car. He didn't have his phone. He didn't have any money.
Things aren't adding up.
The truck was fine and the golf cart was fine. It don't make sense. Nothing broke down for him to have to walk. Somebody's got to know, obviously they know more than they're saying.
There is somebody involved who doesn't want any information to come out, and they keep quashing.
They're calling this crime, and that there are persons responsible.
Well, that would only make sense for a grand jury and everything. Governor's office wouldn't issue something unless they had some kind of probable cause or at least reasonable suspicion that a homicide or something would have occurred.
If you have any information about the murder of Mont Hiley, please contact Alabama State Bureau of Investigation at 334 334- 676-7870 or the SBI Crime Hotline at 800-392-8011. You can also submit an anonymous tip on their website, which will be linked in the episode description. You can also send us a message via our website, ACCA social media pages, or send us an email.
I don't think he left the camp voluntarily.
Since Alabama Cold Case Advocacy's creation, we have dedicated innumerable hours to researching and networking in an effort to provide the largest platform we can to the cases we share. We shoulder all associated expenses with Alabama Cold Case Advocacy out of our own pocket, including the subscription fees for researching and production of the Unforgotten podcast, to provide a cost-free avenue for the victims' families of those cases.
We hope you will join in our efforts to raise awareness of Alabama's missing and murdered and support these families who have been forced to carry the immeasurable loss of their loved ones and the fight for answers. If you appreciate our mission and you are inspired to make a donation, your extra support will enable the ACCA to continue our research, share the cold cases, and help those families know that they are also unforgotten.
Unforgotten is an Alabama Cold Case Advocacy podcast recorded in conjunction with Riverside FM, hosted and distributed by Spotify for Podcasters, available on your favorite podcast platform. Intro music for the show was created by Principles of Uncertainty, who also mixed and mastered this episode. Content and production is by Sellers and Stormy. Artwork by Sellers. Credits for music, sound clips, special mentions, and any source referenced in our podcast can be found in each episode's description. We hope you will join us on all the major social media sites and continue to raise awareness of our Alabama cold cases. Until next time, thank you for listening, and remember, justice may be delayed, but the victims and their families remain unforgotten.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.